I'm going to read to you from Scripture, the passage I'll be preaching on in a moment, or part of it. I'm going to read 1 Kings chapter 10. 1 Kings chapter 10, I'm going to read up to verse 13. Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And when the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he had offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. And she said to the king, "The report was true, though I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom. But I did not believe the report until I came and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the report that I heard. Happy are your men, happy are your servants, who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Moreover, the fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought from Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones. And the king made of the almug wood supports for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, also lyres and harps for the singers. No such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. And King Solomon gave the Queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked beside what was given her by the bounty of King Solomon. And so she turned and went back to her own land with her servants. Well, last week we thought about a terrible situation that often we see Christian leaders, particularly perhaps better known ones, often very sound ones, in a scandal. Either they fall away, they just give up their faith, or they commit adultery, or financial or sexual abuse, bullying, and manipulation. And we're shocked by it, we're confused by it. And we saw last week in 1 Kings chapter 9 that we're told to expect it. And we started to see some answers to our questions as to why it happens and how we respond to that. A few of you asked some very good questions or made some very interesting comments afterwards. One of them asked by Carmen, how can Solomon be so wise and then go so wrong? Well, we'll start to answer that question, but only as far as we can. We can't completely answer it. This week we see Solomon's blessings are even greater than we saw last week, but also so is his fall. But this low point, with all its warnings that we need, also leaves us with a mark of mercy and hope. We've got like three scenes that I want to sort of look at. The first is the glory of the king and the kingdom, and then where it all goes wrong, and then in judgment, mercy. So the first one is the glory of the king and kingdom. We're actually looking at all of, not just what I read, but also all of chapter 10 and chapter 11 as well. So first, the glory of the king and the kingdom in verses 1 to 13. And it's a picture of what God's king should be and why being part of his kingdom should be a good thing. And it's a bit like watching a young child. So if you know someone over the course of their life and you may recall them as a young child saying then there were signs of what they'd grow up to be. You know, maybe they'd become a professional musician or sports person. You're going, you come to think of it, when I remember them at five, how they did such and such. You know, it all makes sense how they've grown up. And in a sense, this is what we see in parts of the Bible, particularly in Solomon, that we see this ideal of the ideal king, ideal kingdom. And that's what it's going to grow up to be like in Jesus Christ and his kingdom. And that's set up for us to see that particularly clearly through this person, the Queen of Sheba. Now, where is Sheba, you might ask? And Ethiopia is probably the most popular idea. And Yemen is another one. Scholars go for Yemen, a few people, maybe Iran. The answer is we don't really know. The important thing is, actually, I don't think it's Iran because Jesus refers to her as coming from the south. But the most important thing is that she is a powerful woman and she's a skeptic who converts. So verses 1-5 is the arrival of the Queen of Sheba, and it's very grand, as the piece of music is. And you see her grandeur and wealth and power. But even she, with all her power, is overwhelmed by Solomon. And lists what strikes her. His wisdom comes up. The house, the worship. And actually, through this chapter, there's sort of a blurring of the temple and Solomon's house and the people who serve in the temple and those who serve Solomon, the sort of religious and secular sort of blurred, and his servants at the table and the clothes and the wealth of his servants. To a point, verse 5, it takes a breath away, literally. And so in verses 6-9, you get her response to that. So verse 7, she confesses that she didn't believe it until she saw it. And now she's seeing she's only been told half of it. She tested Solomon. Solomon can always answer her in wisdom. And she comments that even his slaves are wealthy and happy. And so verse 10, she pays him homage in gold and spices. In verse 5, she comes with gold and spices. Verse 10, she pays them. Just flag that. That's going to be repeated a bit later, gold and spices. And then in turn, verse 13, Solomon blesses her with whatever she wants. So she hears about Solomon and she goes and she hears and sees it personally. And the king's words and the contentment of his people, and she's convinced. Just to break my thread for a second, I think that's a challenge to God's people, that they're meant to look to us and how we experience Christ, and what they see and hear it for themselves. And and that's a challenge. And also, I suppose, if you're listening in, to go and find, do what the Queen of Sheba did. She didn't just listen in her palace. She went to find out for herself. And then chapter 10 focuses on her, but we see that she's not alone. Now, maybe she's the most powerful and the most distant, but she's not unique in some senses. She's one of many. So in verses 14 to 25, there's more about the glory of the king. So verse 14, 666 talents of gold. To put that in our language, 22 tons, which is $1 billion, roughly, which is over 700 million pounds of gold. And from that, Solomon makes shields. He makes a throne of ivory. You have these animals, real animals, imported apes and peacocks, but also symbolic animals that are made from the gold around his throne. What does it look like? Well, very gaudy, very bling. But also what we see is a man ruling up, and it's got these steps going up to him. He ascends, and he goes. So he's like a man ruling over creation. This is Adam. This is what humanity is meant to be like, ruling over the world, ruling over creation. Also, Solomon has been called God's son. And so there's some symbolism here that Solomon, actually, the way he's been presented here is godlike. God rules above the earth. Solomon, not quite above the earth, but a bit lower than God. He's ruling the earth, is the symbolism. Now look at verses 23 and 24. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom, and the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. So he is the king of kings in his wisdom and his wealth, and now beginning to be his power, and nations want to come to him. And look what happens when they do. Verse 25. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses and mules, so much year by year. So just the same as the Queen of Sheba in verse 5 and in verse 10, they bring gold, myrrh, and spices. Is that ringing any bells yet? The Magi from the East and the, we've looked at that before, Christmas, on the build-up to Christmas or just after Christmas. The whole point that Matthew's making is that there are Gentiles from distant lands coming to the King of Kings with their gold, myrrh, and spices, specifically frankincense, and they're bowing down and bringing their homage, a picture of what Christ is going to do ultimately. So what happens under Solomon is the message of the king goes out to the nations, and the nations come to see and seek audience with the king and to bring honor to him. They bring their best gold, myrrh, and spices. And that's how the Bible ends as well, with the nations coming into the New Jerusalem and bringing their wealth before the Lamb on the throne. So it's a picture of what's to come. But also it's it shows us where we are and who we are, rather. What it means to be a servant of the Lord is to be sat at his table. Now we do that symbolically, particularly at the meal, where by faith we sat at the Lord's Supper. We're fed then, but also we're fed by faith on his word. And that looks forward to the great heavenly banquet. Also think of the book of Ephesians. People are meant to look at the church and see God's wisdom, as the Queen of Sheba did. And our charge is to take the gospel to the nations. And Jesus also spoke of the Queen of Sheba. He called her the Queen of the South, not just the Scottish football team. But he spoke of her as a warning, that she will be there at the Last Judgment, condemning those who did not listen to King Jesus. The idea is that here's a woman from a long way away, and someone who could have been quite proud of what she had. But she came and in King Solomon discovered the promise of Christ. And those of us who've got easier access to this, to not be condemned by her by ignoring it. So it's a wonderful picture, as we keep seeing with Solomon. But then we see the next picture is, where does it all go wrong? And we see this in chapter 10, verse 26 to 11, 8. Now, obviously, Solomon is not Jesus, it goes without saying. But we need to see where and how he goes wrong. So Solomon is a signpost that points us to Jesus, but he's also a warning sign pointing to us. And he goes wrong in two steps. The first one is in verses 26 to 29, in amongst the glory. So verses 26 to 28, there's lots about horses and chariots, actually the way through to verse 29 about horses and chariots. And you think, well, why not? They're glorious, like the gold, all these things, and the apes and peacocks, all these things are making him appear glorious. It also makes sense, doesn't it, to have military security and have the best military technology. Apart from, it's against God's law. There are specific laws to kings, and one of them is not to amass horses and no chariots. No chariots, and it sounds like Egypt again. We saw that last week. Solomon was beginning to sound like Pharaoh. And he's made, a few times we have that link made for us, that the sort of Egypt-Pharaoh link with Solomon. And then verse 29, not only does he have all these massing these horses and chariots, but he starts this import-export business. He imports horses and chariots from Egypt and he exports them to the Hittites and to Syria. Well, this is pragmatic, this is good business, and again, against God's law. These are their enemies. Now, he's in a state of peace with them at the moment, but he is giving them, or enabling them, to access advanced weaponry that later is going to be used by them against God's people. So that's the first step. The second step is in chapter 11, verses 1 to 8. We read about Solomon's wives and concubines, I suppose official girlfriends. And in verse 3, it says he had 700 wives who were princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. And you can just imagine being the local florist in Jerusalem and, you know, just recovering from the last Solomon wedding. It's like me again. Some have said, I've got to put it in this context. This is a harem, which is a political thing, because marriage is made alliances. You look at where Israel's on a map, he would have made alliances with, well, we know Egypt and these other nations. And not that that makes it right, but it kind of makes it understandable. But there's certain things here that point to it being a bit more than that, as if that wasn't bad enough. So in the Old Testament and New Testament too, there are specific injunctions about marrying outside of God's people. So if you're in God's people, you should marry from within that community, which is actually not that small. The Old Testament specify those people listed here, those specific nations. Verse 2, it says, he clung to them in love. So it's not just he had to do it for politics. He clung to them in love. And verse 3, they turned his heart away. Verse 4, he loved their gods. And it goes on, not wholly, he wasn't wholly devoted to the Lord. So notice Solomon never stopped believing God. He probably thought that the Lord was the chief of gods, like the Greeks had Zeus. So it's called a pantheon. So it's like a parliament of gods. And the Lord God would have been maybe like the prime minister. The problem is not unbelief entirely. The problem is his heart is shared. And here, not just you get a list of where the wives are from, but a list of some of their gods and goddesses. Couple to take note of is Chemosh, who's a bit like Molech, who you might have heard of. Part of that worship involved child sacrifice, putting your children through fire. I've actually been to a site of Chemosh worship or Molech worship, can't remember which, in Tunisia, in just north of Tunisia in Carthage. It's pretty grim. Milcom here, he is actually, we don't know much about him, but it's stated here he's an abomination. That's not going to be good. And Solomon builds them temples and shrines. He joins in with worship to them. Solomon is a multiculturalist. This is multi-faith worship. Some of these gods are a bit less gross than the ones I've just mentioned. But the point is God does not like being shared. There's a warning here for us so that our romantic affections impact our religious affections. That's why it matters who we date and marry. But notice with Solomon, this doesn't happen overnight. This is a build-up over years and years. That over time, slowly and gently, he slips from the Lord. In the book of Revelation, Jesus addresses the seven churches of Asia Minor. And some of the things he says to them is things like, not to lose your first love, not to be lukewarm, not to fall from the height you started. The story of Solomon is bookended by comments about his love. Interestingly, we thought about love this morning as well. So chapter 1 Kings 3:3 says, Solomon loved the Lord and followed the statutes of his father David. 11:4 says, well, we just heard it a moment ago. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord, his God, as was the heart of David, his father. So you see that the bookends of love, he was wholeheartedly with God, and then he's half-heartedly with God. Also, there's just a little comment there he made about his age, that he's getting old. And I think there's a warning for us as well. The sins of youth are obvious in many ways. We know them. But something struck me by an older minister, he's with the Lord now, but in his late 70s and even early 80s, he made a comment, which is that as he gets older, he doesn't get better, he gets slower. And so we might think that as we do mature and we do calm down a bit, that we're immune from certain sins, and actually we're not. We're just slower. But back to the problem we've talked about that is all too acute that we're aware of in our day and age. Gifted leaders who lead people to Christ, people are converted through them, who bless the church, churches mature under them, and then they fall away or they become abusive. Solomon is more complex than just saying, well, he was wise and then he lost the plot. His wisdom leads to glorifying God and blessing the people and drawing people to Christ, drawing people from far nations to the temple. That same wisdom leads him to amass chariots, wives, and other gods. And I've got little doubt that throughout his lifetime, it would have been great to live in the Israel that he ruled. that the average Israelite would have benefited greatly from such a king. And we touched on this last week, but I think it becomes clearer this week, that the wisdom and blessing leads to the problem, because it all goes wrong at the height of his powers. I think he experiences pride when there's a taster of what can be his. We noticed that, didn't we? In chapters 3 and 4, we have a lot about his gold and wisdom. But what does he do with that gold and wisdom? Is it's for Israel's good. We have ordinary people gathered at his table. Chapter 9, we saw it all goes to Solomon. And so for a church or a church leader, we see people coming to Christ and mature because of our words or their words. That God uses means, he uses ordinary churches or ordinary ministers to do remarkable things. Just by speaking about him, people come from death to life. It struck me once when someone gave their testimony. It was talking about a few sermons that I'd done and someone else had done, and said, through those sermons, I met Jesus. It's a remarkable thing that happens through the church and us speaking. And so we're aware that God has used a great power through us. And some churches and some ministers do things really well. And then they have tremendous results, and they amass resources, and they feel the power. And there comes the problem. When we're at our height, we're at our greatest danger and can do the most harm. And so there's a challenge then about how to use what God gives. Now, there's other challenges that perhaps we relate to more at CPC, where when we're at the other end of the scale and we perhaps feel small and weak, there are other temptations that we face. But notice the contrast between Solomon and Christ. We noticed this last week. The Christ is the servant king, that he's not self-serving and is always giving of himself. And so he calls his followers to copy him in that respect. So the danger we see here is enthusiasm and giftedness and a good start leads to success, and then a comfortable half-heartedness. Comfort is often the enemy of faithfulness. What's God going to do about that? Well, this is the third sort of scene we get. And actually, it's a series of scenes that sort of flow together quickly. In judgment, mercy, chapter 11, verses 9 to 43. So Solomon's slow rebellion leads to judgment, but also mercy. Three times in chapter 11, it says God raised up. So verse 14, he raised up Hadad, verse 23, Rezin, and verse 26, Jeroboam. So last week we saw that Solomon was acting like Pharaoh at the time of the Exodus, and that Pharaoh is acting like Moses or Joshua. And here we've got something similar. We've got people who are not God's people being used to show up God's people, particularly Solomon. So Hadad mimics Israel's history, and Rezin David's. So Hadad in verse 9 to 22, when he's a baby, he has to flee to Egypt at the time of David. And while he's in Egypt, he's blessed by Pharaoh. He marries into royalty. And when David dies, Hadad goes to Pharaoh and says, send me out, very much like Moses does. And then he comes out of Egypt to the promised land and is a kind of conquers Solomon. Not quite. Rezin is like David. He's an outlaw who's then raised up. Both of these men work against Solomon. They cause enormous difficulties. They're part of God's judgment on Solomon. But the focus is on this third man, Jeroboam. And he is to Solomon like David was to Saul. So Jeroboam was loyal to Saul, we're told. Solomon recognized him as a mighty warrior, and he was raising him up through the ranks, much as Saul did with David. But then, verses 29 to 39, there's a prophet, Ahijah from Shiloh, tells Jeroboam that he'll be king, much like Samuel tells David, and that this is going to take the kingdom away from, well, in David's case, Saul, in this case, from Solomon or Solomon's son. And so 29 to 32, Ahijah is wearing, actually it's not clear whether the prophet's wearing it or Jeroboam is wearing it, but one of them is wearing a new garment. And the prophet tears it off, which makes it sound like it might be off of Jeroboam rather than off himself. But he takes it off and he tears it into 12 pieces. And you can imagine Jeroboam watching in bemusement as the prophet Ahijah rips it up, counting, you know, one, two, three, up to 12 pieces. And then he gives, Ahijah gives, asks Jeroboam to take back 10. So now Jeroboam has to count 10 off of him. And the reason he says is that he'll take 10 tribes from the son of Solomon, leaving Solomon one. Now, most of your maths would know that 10 plus one doesn't, you've got one left over. You can ask questions about that at the end if you want. And so Solomon acts towards Jeroboam as Saul did to David with intense jealousy and murderous intent. He wants him killed. Right up to the point that Solomon dies. And at that point, the kingdom splits. 10 going to the north with Jeroboam and a couple to the south. The David-Solomon line is in the south and Jeroboam off in the north. So notice Solomon is like Saul. He's angry and murderous towards Jeroboam. At no point, though, does he think to repent. And so we see the consequence of Solomon's drift is that the next generation lose the land, or the people are divided. Now, this is something I think is really interesting. It's really interesting to see this thing in the Bible, and we see it through history as well. Is sometimes backsliding and unfaithfulness, it has an immediate result, but often it takes a generation or two for it to actually bite. And we see more of that as we go through 1 and 2 Kings. And so the problem in the church, often people go, oh, there's a problem. Here is a problem. We've got something going wrong. We've got division. We've got finances, numbers are dropping. And we get very stressed as to what we're doing now. But actually, the problem happened a few years ago, maybe even a generation ago. The problem starts often when things looked good. And same the other way round. The fruit of obedience sometimes can have a very quick blessing. But sometimes the right things that we do now aren't seen for years. And sometimes they're not seen in our lifetime. Because we're doing a big building project. Think of those medieval cathedrals taking 100 years. Well, how many, you know, those who started the work didn't see the end work. The architect never saw the end work. Remember the first readers at the end of 2 Kings. They're in exile and they're thinking, why are we here? What hope do we have? And they're reading this and they're going, this is the best of kings with all the resources at his hand. But they were torn down by his half-heartedness with God. Now, what does that then tell us about our priorities? Well, it means that love of God is the highest value, and wholehearted love of God is of the highest value. Yes, we want wisdom. We want chariots and resources. We want dynamic leaders who will lead us to great success. But actually, God values love and our hearts and obedience. And the results, well, they can be a bit slow in coming, frankly. And so there's a realism here, perhaps. The wisest man failed. So that doesn't give much hope to those sitting there in exile, nor us. What do we need if the wisest king falls? Well, we need wisdom personified. And Jesus Christ, we're told, is God's wisdom for us. He is the king that never failed, and his obedience is actually credited to you by faith as if it was your own. And our sin is also given to him, and he dies taking the curse for us. And here in chapter 11, there's also hope and mercy, because verse 38 and 39. So in amongst all this judgment, the prophet tells Jeroboam, and if you will listen to all I command you and walk in all my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and my commands as David, my servant, did, I will be with you and will build your sure house as I built for David. And I will give Israel to you, and I will afflict the offspring of David because of this, but not forever. And he says similar words to Solomon earlier on, that he remembers his promise to David. So God's judgment is real, and it's not to be messed with, but he made a promise to David. He sealed it by an oath in a covenant that God is bound to a course of action, and he will not abandon that course of action. So there will always be a king on the throne of David. He left the southern kingdom to Solomon and his sons. And there's a hope for those who were away in exile that he's going to restore that king to David's line. Now, we have the vantage point of coming after the New Testament, and we know he's talking here about Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ doesn't just restore the land, but takes us to a better land, to the new creation. And we see Solomon, it's just a faint reflection of what heaven is talking about, as we see Christ sat above creation and us sat a little lower than him, over creation with him, but at his table. And that wonderful picture Jesus talks about, that Jesus himself comes and serves his servants. In the meantime, we try to do our best as a church to love and to obey. And at times, churches, leaders will be an extreme disappointment and cause hurt. And we understand why. We understand the consequences of that. And we're warned to avoid those and to plan a course through that. And when they fail, and in the future there will be more, we also know God's covenant, promise, and mercy. He will judge, but he will remember mercy.